You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus of New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. For as long as I can remember, and that's quite a long time, veterans' issues and things affecting veterans across this nation, for whatever reason, have certainly hit home. Many times we look upon our veterans as the heroes, which they are, people who put their lives on the line, people who put themselves front and center. But in addition to that, there's also been a lot of controversy regarding veterans and the wars and the engagements that this country has entered into. And that's why my guest this week is Jasper Craven. He's the co-author of the new book, Veterans Affairs, where he deals with those issues, along with two other authors, Susan Gordon and Steve Early. The book is out in our veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. So I've asked Jasper to join me this evening to talk about the motivations for writing the book and what he was able to find out. Jasper, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, appreciate it.
This issue, I know you're a reporter and you cover a lot of issues, but, you know, veterans, something must have clicked with you personally, perhaps. Am I correct in assuming that was one of the motivations for jumping in and becoming one of the co-authors of this book?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, I don't have any immediate sort of family ties to the military. I mean, my best friend is an Air Force fighter pilot. Obviously, I have, you know, grandparents and great-grandparents who served, just because back then, you know, so many Americans did have some record of service. But it's actually funny. My father was involved in the anti-war movement during Vietnam. So, you know, I mean, I sort of certainly was raised on, you know, an education by him and by others, you know, just in school as well, learning about American conflict and the history of veterans issues to some degree. I mean, but there isn't a whole lot of attention focused on American men and women once they return home. You know, I mean, it's sort of the curriculum that focuses on the world wars, but then not what happened in the interim and sort of the struggles of veterans once they return. My sort of entree into this topic came in 2014. I'm originally from Vermont, and I was in Washington, D.C., stringing for two Vermont newspapers covering our congressional delegation. And Bernie Sanders was chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee that summer. This was obviously before he mounted his presidential bid the first time. And there was a pretty, it was a sleepy summer in Washington, but there was a scandal that exploded when I was covering Bernie and the committee at a Veterans Affairs hospital in Phoenix. You and your listeners may remember, it was essentially alleged that VA administrators were cooking the appointment books to suggest improperly that veterans were getting in for care in shorter windows than was actually happening. Mm-hmm. This sort of spurred a lot of headlines, and Bernie basically worked closely with the late John McCain to forge a bill to fix the issue called the VA Choice Act. Bernie's part of that bill essentially was to put more money in the VA, to hire officials, to boost infrastructure so that wait times would be reduced. And then McCain's effort was to essentially open up the door for veterans to see private sector doctors under certain conditions. So that was sort of my entree into the VA, my introduction to veterans policy. And, you know, I mean, it was interesting because when I was there covering it, so much of Washington, it's these little packs of reporters following the big shiny red ball. But there wasn't a whole lot of attention paid to the Veterans Affairs Committee or VA in general. And, you know, I mean, it's such a massive agency that sort of a few years later, once I was deciding where to focus my work, the VA sort of emerged as a natural area of focus.
Yeah, and a good point, because and two things that you mentioned that I just want to bring forward, because I certainly remember 1968, the midst of the Vietnam War, and there was a draft going on. I don't know if some people, especially younger generations, do not realize that many men, whether they believed in the war or not, whether they wanted to serve or not, really didn't have a choice. You had to sign for the draft, and if you did get drafted and then sent overseas, it usually was Vietnam. But there was a lot of turmoil. People were really opposed to the war, and the morale of what I'm getting at is the morale of U.S. servicemen and women. Certainly, you know, it was probably at an all-time low. They're figuring, look, I'm not here by my choice. I'm fighting for my life. I'm fighting for my country. And back home, people were not very supportive. And then, as you were talking about, Jasper, you know, VA hospitals, we had an issue, and I don't want to make that the focus of the interview because it's certainly not where we're going with this. But here in Western Massachusetts, the abuses that were going on there. So, you know, a lot of things. And I'm really glad that you brought, through the book, brought this to the surface. But as you said, the VA and Veterans Affairs, massive organization, and you know, like anything that's that large, some people say, well, you know, they lose control. They can't focus on what they need to focus on, what they had the intent of doing so. Did you find, in other words, is the chaos, is the confusion part of the size of the organization or the fact that there's just not enough people who really care?
I mean, it's a complicated issue, and, you know, I mean, certainly the VA post-Vietnam was a total mess. The agency had essentially been allowed to wither post-World War II, and so it just was not at all prepared for this influx of Vietnam veterans. I mean, the other thing is that PTSD wasn't even a malady until post-Vietnam. It wasn't recognized until the early 80s. And right. So all of these vets were coming home, and the docs just did not know what to do with them. They did not have any sorts of mental health treatments to make them feel better. So that was sort of, I would say, peak chaos in the VA. And, you know, as for the VA today, it is certainly a massive bureaucracy comparable to the Pentagon, of course. And, you know, in any organization that large, there's going to be issues and bad apples and, you know, things won't be perfect. The thing with the VA is that, I mean, the sort of coin of the realm, people say, you know, if you've been to one VA, you've been to one VA. And I think that's in some ways true. You know, there are incredible VA hospitals across the country. And, you know, if you look at peer-reviewed research that compares care quality, that compares cost, that even does compare timeliness of care in the VA to the private sector, the VA almost always outperforms the private sector. So, I mean, you know, that's not saying a lot. I mean, I think people like me who go in the private sector, oftentimes we have issues, too, with the care that we're getting and how long it takes to get in and certainly how expensive it is. And so, you know, I think the VA struggles, yes, because it's one leader running this massive organization, the largest integrated healthcare system in the country. But, you know, I think there are other strengths inside the VA that sometimes get overlooked. And, you know, veterans, by and large, despite issues that do emerge, they prefer the VA to the private sector. I mean, the other thing, too, is that a lot of these issues come out, and rightfully so, because the VA is subject to oversight by two congressional committees, by various federal watchdogs, including the Government Accountability Office and Office of Inspector General. And so, you know, there's constantly people rooting around the VA looking for problems and then writing public reports about those problems. And then the VA, you know, hopefully fixes those problems. Most of the time it does. Whereas in the private sector, a lot of medical malpractice, things like that, they never actually get out into the public eye because private executives, you know, will have settlements. They will, you know, have patients sign NDAs, things like that. So it's sort of difficult in the public eye to understand how the two compare. But generally, when you look at the two systems compared to each other, the VA warts and all, and again, I know it's certainly not a perfect system. I know there's been issues in Massachusetts. There was issues in Phoenix. There's been issues at other facilities that have popped up, that routinely pop up. But on the whole, VA generally outperforms the private sector.
Yeah, and what I've also found is once this does come to light, there seems to be an immediate attention and focus on rectifying the problem. I know there has been tremendous pressure among congressional delegates from Massachusetts, and even those who are, you know, part and parcel of the Veterans Administration, even in Washington, who want to, as you said, want to fix the problem. We talked a little bit. You said you had no known relatives that were veterans. I had a couple of uncles, a couple of cousins that served, but the two uncles in World War II, I don't recall them getting anything coming back. Going back many years now, but I didn't sense any bitterness either. They're very proud. And as I said, for the longest time, there was this back and forth. Many people, especially those who could relate, family members, fellow veterans, certainly took each other's needs and wants to heart. But there was a percentage of Americans, and perhaps even to this day, Jasper, you'd probably know better than I, who still frown upon that. But I think, I guess my question is, did any of you, the other co-authors or yourself, have the opportunity to sit down with any veterans one-on-one to get a sense of how they feel? I mean, I don't think people can put themselves into their shoes until you actually sit with a veteran and say, you know, what's it been like since you've been back? I mean, are you back working? Did you get your life back together? Because many have never, as you said, never been able to do that. But did you have the opportunity to talk to any veterans?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been one of the real pleasures about focusing on these issues for so long is that, you know, I mean, I grew up, again, in a small town in Vermont, and, you know, there were certainly veterans in the community, and we would go to the 4th of July and, you know, Memorial Day parades, and right. We would get access to that community in those ways. But it's so much more beneficial to engage in a deep way with vets and hear what they're thinking and feeling and you know, sort of trying to share those experiences, because military service is becoming increasingly a family business that's confined to specific communities, many of them poor and rural and in the South. And so, you know, there's a real danger here, and I think it's really already happening, in which this community is really getting sort of abstracted. You know, there's what a lot of people describe as sort of a growing civilian-military divide, which can breed a lot of resentment and also just misunderstanding, because, you know, veterans don't feel like civilians understand what they've gone through. Civilians sort of have a caricatured idea of what a veteran is, and they sort of, you know, do the bare minimum to thank them for their service and understand what they need. And so it's really just, it's not a good picture. And when you speak to veterans, yes, you hear a lot of concerns and struggles with transitioning back to civilian life, with finding a job, with finding purpose, with feeling disillusioned. You know, there's also a lot of vets who've used their service, their skills learned in the service to be positive leaders in the community, and who, you know, have maintained connections to the military and to their veteran community through groups like the American Legion or the VFW. But it's, you know, it's becoming increasingly difficult. You know, the American Legion, for instance, which is considered the largest veterans organization in the world, has seen its power greatly diminish over the last two decades, just because, you know, its members are dying off. It's lost millions of members. And so another thing that we deal with in the book is we look at how the diminishing power of groups like the American Legion, which again are tied to the reduction in the veteran population, lead to issues on Capitol Hill where, you know, key benefits like the GI Bill are sort of put in jeopardy because there just isn't the same power, the same constituency to defend those rights. I mean, veterans have a very strong social safety net that they have fought for vigorously over many, many centuries. You know, each sort of generation of veterans has taken the torch from the last and really fought for services and support, but it becomes difficult to secure those services the smaller the population becomes. And I think we're actually sort of seeing that play out right now. If you've been following this bill that's stalled in Congress that's supposed to give health care benefits to veterans sickened by exposure to toxic chemicals, whether it's burn pits for the post 9/11 generation, or even, you know, to sort of increase services for those who were exposed to dioxin and Agent Orange in Vietnam.
You know, that's a great, great point, because I think you're absolutely right. You talk about that World War, I say that post-World War II and even the Korean War veterans, they're dying off. They're very few. And I want to continue in that vein because you've kind of lit the candle. I want to just take a quick pause to remind folks that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is journalist and author Jasper Craven. The new book is Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. And we're talking about veterans from as far back as World War, if there any still exist, World War I through current day, the treatment and the advocacy that has been put forth and the hard work that they've had to endure just to get a voice. And Jasper, just what you were saying, and I found a solidarity, and you're right, the American Legion and the solidarity, especially of post-World War II and Korean War veterans, but they're a small minority today because they're dying off. I have talked to veterans, you know, Vietnam and beyond. I'm not saying that they're turning their backs on their fellow veterans, not at all. All I'm saying is I don't find the same cohesiveness. So with that said, and you know as well as anybody, if you don't have a strong voice in Washington, things probably aren't going to move very quickly. So our veterans, regardless of where they were or what engagement, what time period that they served, are they more in jeopardy today than any time in past history?
I think so. I think they're sort of facing a crisis. And, you know, as I said, you can see this in the fact that it's so difficult to pass you know, common sense veterans legislation these days. I mean, you know, the other sort of troubling fact, for a long time, it was sort of considered that the House and the Senate Veterans Affairs Committees were sort of the last places in Washington that were free of politics and special interests. But a few years ago, I actually did an analysis, and I found that over the last decade, the donations from corporate interests to these veterans committees and the lawmakers on them has doubled to something like $12 million. Similarly, the amount of lobbying of these groups by corporate and ideological interests has spiked. So basically what you see when those pernicious influences start taking an interest in the VA, and the VA, again, you know, massive agency, there's a lot of money to be had by private interests if you want it. What you see is they're, you know, getting, for instance, contracts to offer sketchy snake oil PTSD treatments to veterans. You see groups like the University of Phoenix, for-profit private colleges, who are taking advantage of GI Bill dollars, getting rich while offering veterans a useless education. You see groups, private for-profit groups, that are actually offering claims assistance, you know, for veterans to get their disability ratings. This was a job that historically was done for free by groups like the American Legion, but as they're influence and power and funding diminishes, there are these private groups that are stepping in, charging thousands of dollars to vets, often for pretty shoddy services. So a lot of these benefits are under jeopardy, and a lot of the help that veterans have secured are evaporating.
So I get the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, as slow and as laborious as it can be to deal with a government organization, they at least were, as you said, perhaps not taking advantage of the situation where the more that this thing becomes privatized, then veterans are at the mercy of, you know, God knows who. You know, anybody can put out a shingle tomorrow morning and say, you know, we're offering this great health plan, or we can tie you into an education format that'll provide you with all the requirements you need to, you know, go back into the private sector, and you'll be all set. And I've heard that. I've heard that from veterans, that they're not getting the adequate service. And you talked about the Congress, and I keep thinking, you mentioned John McCain. I keep thinking about John McCain because, one, he was a veteran, and two, a POW. So he really, nobody knew war. Nobody knew the suffering that servicemen and women go through than John McCain. And he was really the lion in spearheading, especially when it came to veterans. But when they don't have, I guess what I'm saying, Jasper, is when they don't have a voice, especially one who hasn't had that personal experience. And I'm not saying that you don't have your heart in it when you've never worn a uniform or carried a backpack or a rifle. I'm not saying that at all. But McCain had a more personal attachment to veterans. When they lose someone like a John McCain, and I'm talking about in the public sector, that certainly stymies things. But again, going back to what we were talking about, to clarify things, I'm getting the sense that, you know, privatizing a lot of these services might not be the most advantageous way to go for veterans. Am I reading this right?
Yeah, I think that's what we have found in our reporting for this book. I mean, you know, to be clear, if a vet needs a service from their VA hospital and the VA can't offer it because it's like a specialty or something, or, you know, it's just going to take too long to get in the door, they can go see a private sector doc, and that's long been a rule in the VA. So certainly there are instances where, you know, private options, whether it's in healthcare or, you know, for higher education, that makes total sense. But I think what we're seeing right now is a real push to cannibalize the agency and just sort of, like you said, privatize it. And, you know, there's just a lot of issues that accompany it. I mean, you know, fundamentally, the private sector has a profit motive, and the government, you know, for all its flaws and issues, does not. And so you just start to see these various, you know, programs and services try to take advantage of veterans. I mean, you also see this sort of, frankly, in the nonprofit and charity space. You know, there have been so many veterans charities that have emerged post 9/11, tens of thousands, actually. And of course, a lot of these charities do incredible work to support veterans and offer really great supplemental services. There are also many that claim that they're helping veterans when in fact they're collecting paychecks and, you know, using the money to support lavish lifestyles. I mean, it's been wild to see how many of sort of the worst charity scams have emerged in the veteran space, because of course, you know, this is a population that the public wants to help. And yet you see groups like the Wounded Warrior Project a few years ago. There's also another group that I investigated a few years ago called the Independence Fund that claimed to be offering all-terrain wheelchairs to veterans, when in fact a lot of the money was going to the organization's leader to go on, you know, all expense paid trips to Disneyland or buy cars or go on shopping sprees. And so, you know, it's just, again, it really is a sort of crisis moment for this population. And yet, you know, you don't have defenders in Washington who, you know, who have a military background and who really want to support the community. Post-Vietnam, for instance, 73% of lawmakers in Washington had a military service record. At this point, there's a few dozen.
Right.
And so, you know, there's also a case to be made that the sort of the lack of shared military experience in Congress has also contributed to the growing polarization.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a real good point. And the other thing, and you mentioned it in the book, the division, the generational divide. And what I mean by that is just what you said. Post-World War II and Korea, you would find quite a few veterans serving in Congress. Today, that's not the case. Not only that, Jasper, but at least for you and I, because we were born in that era, Vietnam, this country has really not had a widespread need to put boots on the ground. Yes, there's Afghanistan and Pakistan, and there have been terrorist organizations where we've had to put our military. But I'm talking about basically a worldwide engagement. So I think a lot of people have lost focus. When you're in the midst of a war. In fact, I just finished a book about Teddy Roosevelt coming out of the First World War and the animosity and the feelings of people at that era. But I don't get the sense, unless you're a veteran, and you said it yourself, unless you're a veteran and you're going through these things, or your family is going through certain things, you can't appreciate what they're going. And then there's the quagmire of social media. As you said, you or I could put out a notice tomorrow morning that we're advocating for veterans. Probably, if you got half a brain, you can organize and start raising money, and then it goes into the hands of the wrong people. And I don't blame veterans. But going back to what I said, this division. I mean, are they as cohesive? If you get a 35-year-old veteran versus a 75-year-old veteran, is the 35-year-old willing to stand shoulder to shoulder, with his compatriot? Versus what veterans from World War II and the Korean War. I mean, because you know yourself, one loud voice makes all the difference in the world. So these guys aren't shoulder to shoulder, especially a younger generation, then they've got less of a voice in Congress, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you saw a real divide emerge between the World War II generation and Vietnam. I think, again, the World War II generation, I mean, those two, warfare was developing so rapidly over the first course, the first half of the 20th century that, these veterans had experienced wildly different types of warfare and been exposed, obviously to some shared experiences and traumas, but there were just so much different in the culture, in the treatment they received when they came home, in the sort of, experience of conflict. And this has continued to develop into the 21st century. But I think there have been sort of unfortunate divides that have emerged from conflict to conflict. I think you've also seen, however, especially with the Vietnam generation, an effort to build and maintain ties. One of the charter missions of the Vietnam Veterans of America, in addition to fighting for, veterans benefits and things like that, was to ensure that no new generation was ever left behind in the same way that the Vietnam folk did. And so you've actually seen a lot of really encouraging and beautiful work from Vietnam vets and post 9/11 vets, where the Vietnam generation is sort of teaching the post 9/11 guys and girls how to lobby Washington and how to push for legislation and how to build connections in the veterans community. I've spoken to a lot of post 9/11 advocates who really say they owe a service to some of these Vietnam guys for teaching them how to sort of navigate veteran life. So, I think certainly divides can still exist and do exist, but there has been, I think, some good good developments in terms of solidarity over the last couple of decades.
Let's certainly hope so. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I'm really glad. I mean, the book is eye-opening. The book is motivating, and you don't have to be a veteran. You said it yourself. It's you know, never turn your back on those who either through a their own initiative or whether it was government mandated to serve this country, and we have to remember the sacrifice that many, many of them made. Jasper, real quick, if people want to pose questions, get more information about the work that you do, is there a website or a way of reaching out to you?
Yeah, if folks are interested, they can just go to ourvetbook.com. There you can find access to the book as well as contact information for myself and some of the other co-authors.
And again, the book is Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. And my guest has been co-author Jasper Craven. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. I certainly welcome questions and comments and feedback from you, our listening audience. And you can reach me at Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the Public Eye, this is Al Bowman.